family case conferences as a part of a restorative justice program is, I gather, something of an innovation that the New Zealand justice system has brought to the world. I've had two experiences of those, a good one and a very bad one, and I want to talk about the good experience first of all this morning. In my life in Wellington, my vicarage was visited one evening by what's called a stair dancer, that is to say, a street criminal who goes down a street trying doors and going into open, you know, some flats have their doors open all the time, just trying doors randomly to see if they can opportunistically steal something. Well, the police caught him shortly afterwards, and a few weeks later I was invited to one of these family case conferences. His father was there along with a young man, and the father had a plan to move to a new locality with a job arranged for the boy, and the boy would live with him. So far, so good. But then when the social worker and I turned the conversation to the affairs of daily living, the way they had structured their life, things became a little more problematical, because it turned out there was no tradition in this family of ever sitting down to a meal table to have a meal together in the evening, at which, of course, news and views are shared and people catch up with each other. Just convenience food was bolted down and the boy raced off, which meant, of course, that peer group influence was high and parental influence was low. We began to try and bargain our way to at least getting him to agree that there should be one of these kind of family meals a week. But one could tell by the puzzled, sceptical look on his face that this perhaps wasn't going to happen. I've often wondered what's happened to that boy. You know, food's a metaphor for the quality of our interactions, our social interactions, and customs about eating and food have powerful shaping influences on our culture and our society and about the way people relate to each other. I say all this by way of background to that very puzzling gospel reading about the eating customs of Jews. And it's one of those gospel passages where you'd be inclined to think, can we please turn the page and get onto something inspiring, consoling and helpful? Why are we being invited to consider this in-house fight about food customs of the Jewish people of 2,000 years ago? Well, the reason is that the Jewish people marked themselves out as a distinctive people for their own social cohesion and survival by these remarkable customs. This was how they survived foreign conquest, exile. It was a way they kept their distinctive identity markers. And as the Christian churches begin to emerge out of the matrix of this Jewish culture, they have to start making decisions about how much of the Jewish law will they keep. Some churches, the one based in Palestine, kept all of the Jewish law and combined that with faith in Jesus. Some churches kept some of the parts of the Jewish law, and some, particularly the ones founded by Paul in the Gentile world around the Mediterranean, kept very few parts of the Jewish law indeed. But that didn't get them off the hook about fights about food. You may recall the preoccupation in much of the letter to the Romans about, well, what do I do if my next door neighbour invites me to dinner and they say they're pagans? Oh, by the way, the meat here was offered to Zeus or Apollo this morning. Can I, with integrity, eat this food? And let's recall the way in which the sacred meal we're celebrating this morning was first observed. It was a kind of bring a plate occasion, the love feast. We actually recreated this a few years ago, a meal together, in the middle of which we would remember the sacred words and ritual actions of Jesus. But the sacred meal, the so-called love feast, had tremendous practical problems around it, particularly in the Corinthian church, where the rich brought lots of good food and drink, and their custom shamed the poor, where the heavy drinkers became intoxicated, and where others treated the whole meal in such a trivial fashion that it undermined the solemnity of the sacred meal. Which is why the Eucharist has evolved to the point where we've got it today, because out of these turbulent experiences, the church came to understand the importance of having sound ground rules, that the rituals and ceremonies were important to kind of prevent the things that had undermined the love feast within a generation. This is still a sacred meal, but a highly stylized one, and it's for our protection. It's to make sure that it can become a point of contact between us and God, that these rules exist. Now, the liturgical movement, which has arose in the 20th century, began to ask searching questions about the barnacle-like accretions that have been added to Christian liturgies over the year, began to look at the way in which the sacred meal is celebrated and to ask some searching questions about it. For instance, in this first part of the service, the Liturgy of the Word, it's important to get to the readings as soon as possible and not to get distracted by other things. In the second part of the service, what matters is the great Thanksgiving prayer over the bread and wine. This should not be obscured by other mini-rites. Anthony de Mello, the Indian Jesuit, told a very good story about the guru and his cat. The guru, when he led his monks in worship and meditation in the meditation hall, his cat would often wander into the meditation hall and make himself at home amongst the monks. After the guru died, the monks decided that no service should start in the meditation hall unless the cat was present. This was an important ritual action. After the cat died, the cat was stuffed and put in a place of honour in the meditation hall to honour it as an essential part of the liturgy. And this is the kind of thing that human beings can often do in their worship customs. But it's not so much about our ritual eating customs and the sacred meal that I want to talk about this morning, but to be concerned about what I call the death of ritual outside in our culture and our society. The way in which the cult of informality seems to be undermining in 100 little ways the habits and customs of hospitality. People invite each other around to meals fewer times than they do. And I notice at weddings now, people often turn up dressed very informally. I want to tell you a story about a wedding I took at St. Mary's Addington one time. After these weddings, I attended receptions in the rugby football clubs of East Christchurch, one after the other, and finally there was going to be a reception at the Avon Motor Lodge. This would be good, I thought. Finally, a place where a bit of class and a bit of style. And as we sat down to have the meal, the photographer came up to me and said, look, they've done nothing at all about the speeches. You're going to have to step in to be the MC and propose all the toasts. As I rose to my feet, I anxiously tried to recall the order in which wedding toasts are supposed to happen. And the problem with all this, you see, is, I mean, I'm not asking we should subscribe to Cuisine magazine or get into a highly formal customs of the Victorians, but I am concerned about the way in which, like that first family I was talking about in the case conference, it's kind of undermining the quality of our life throughout society. You know, if I preached a sermon 10 years ago, I'd have talked about my concern of the way in which many people kind of ate their evening meal perched on their knees while they watched TV. That's all finished now. Now many people just disappear into cyberspace for hours in the evening, eating as they go. And what I want to say is that a meal, a simple meal, around which a family unites in the evening is a great thing to do. And a wedding reception that's well organised and well thought through honours the couple and honours the families concerned. And a sacred meal that's well organised with clear ground rules that aren't cluttered by too many accretions puts us in touch with God, and it's worth getting up 4 in the morning. Spoken in the name of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. One final thing. The person who's at the centre of our religion based his whole ministry around meals, feasts, contacts with people. You know, he got all this controversy about breaking bread with unrighteous people. So in a sense, he's committed us to fights about food until time ends. Remember when he calls Zacchaeus, sees him up the top of the tree, invites him to come down. Does he say, I'm going to baptize you? Let's go to the temple to pray. No, he says, we're going to your house, have a meal now. Now it's in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit.